Case number 24-1298, World Shipping Council Petitioner versus Federal Maritime Commission and United States of America. Mr. McGovern for the petitioner, Mr. Summers for the respondents.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. McGovern, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert McGovern for petitioner, World Shipping Council. This case addresses whether the Federal Maritime Commission adopted a rule that exceeds its statutory authority under the U.S. Shipping Act and is arbitrary and capricious under the APA. To address COVID-19 supply chain disruptions, including when shippers were competing for very limited vessel space during a time of unprecedented demand, Congress amended the Shipping Act and directed the FMC to adopt a rule that defines the term unreasonable in the context of negotiating and providing vessel space. That rule that it adopted violates the Shipping Act and the APA in three key respects. First, the rule impermissibly allows the FMC to regulate ocean carrier prices, notwithstanding Congress's express repeal of that rate-making authority over 40 years ago. Second, the rule directly interferes with the business of ocean carriers by requiring them to create, file, and then have their actions judged against prospective export policies. And third, the rule consciously jettisons legitimate business reasons as an explicit factor with no meaningful or logical explanation, reversing decades-long precedent that the FMC itself relied on in its own proposed rule. As to the rate-making factor, the rule allows the Commission to consider, quote, the quoting of rates that are so above market rates that they cannot be considered a real offer or an attempt at engaging in good faith negotiations. But Congress explicitly repealed the Commission's statutory rate-making authority in 1984, and it did so for a very specific reason. Quoting legislative history, Congress determined, quote, excessive government involvement has unnecessarily interfered in many aspects of shipping activity where commercial parties more appropriately should govern their own conduct. This is on pages 7 and 8 of our opening brief. And importantly, this statutory regime remains even after OSTR 22 was passed. Now, I expect that my colleague will argue that the rule only allows the Commission to evaluate and not to set rates. But whatever terminology the FMC wants to use, consider, benchmark, evaluate, there's no scenario under which an agency that does not have statutory rate-making authority can then turn around and tell regulated entities that their rates are too high. That rate-making factor in the rule also fails under the APA because the Commission never explained what it means for a rate to be too high. It never explained what methodology it would determine what a reasonable market rate might be in comparison. And it never explained what amount of deviation might between the two would, in the Commission's view, be considered unreasonable. Section 4104 of the Shipping Act also does not allow the Commission to require carriers to create and file prospective export policies. And as always, on questions of statutory...
May I ask you about the business decisions argument?
Of course.
As you know, FMC indicated in the rule, quote, information on business decisions relevant to establishing a reasonable refusal to deal would still be relevant. And I would interpret the APA's arbitrary and capricious standard to require the agency to consider relevant factors when it takes agency action. So putting kind of those two things together, why should I be worried that the FMC will not consider business decisions as a factor when the business decisions are relevant?
Thank you, Your Honor. So we have to start from where the FMC started in the proposed rule. And they had business factors explicitly in there.
I mean, why?
Because they said, we have business factors in here because it is a recognition of our longstanding policy that this is a factor that we consider when addressing reasonableness under the statute. The FMC is not starting from a blank slate here. 41-104, A3, and A10 were already in the statute when OSER 22 passed.
They don't have to persuade us that the final rule is better than the proposed rule. They just have to persuade us that the final rule is reasonable and reasonably explained.
And I think, Your Honor, to answer your question, why should you be concerned? The FMC has made a choice here. The FMC has said that these factors were in the proposed rule, but then we removed them. And we removed them because we had a concern that they had the potential to overwhelm other factors. That's at JA 51. That's not an explanation of departing from your past precedent. What that is saying that a factor is apparently so significant that it has the potential to overwhelm factors, but not significant enough to be listed alongside those in the rule.
I'm going to ask them about that. I do think it's a little wild that that was the best they could do in explaining what they did. But I'm asking you in part because I think it goes a little bit to the merits, but a little bit to standing. If I have every reason to believe that in spite of their, we're not going to include business decisions in the rule because they're too important to include, some version of that. Regardless of that, if I have every reason to believe that information on business decisions that are relevant will be considered, then I'm not sure how a party that says we want business decisions that are relevant to be considered is injured.
Your Honor, I would answer the question, your question, this way. One, the FMC has already signaled in both its rulemaking and its brief that how it wants fact finders to adjudicate these cases. It's making a conscious policy decision now to deprioritize these. They've listed some factors, they've taken business factors, and they said, we may consider them down the road. There's also a slip of the tongue that the FMC makes in both the rule and its brief when it says that it removed business factors from being something that they must consider to being something that they may consider under the regulatory catch-all that you're referring to. Well, our understanding is none of these rules are all of them are a suite of non-exclusive
factors. But even if they said we're changing it to May, if the APA requires them to consider business decisions when the business decisions are relevant, it seems like regardless of whether they said may or must, the APA imposes a must.
And Judge Walker, I would say the FMC has made promises like this before. In a case before this court, Evergreen versus the FMC, involving an FMC interpretive rule, the FMC said in that rule, we'll consider one factor and we may consider a number of other factors. And then the first time that the FMC had to evaluate that, they considered only the one and ignored all the others.
And then what did you do?
We challenged it in court. And what we're hoping to do now is...
I don't remember. Did you?
We did, Your Honor.
So why not? Why isn't that, from a standing perspective, injury that's either now or imminent, why wouldn't we require you to do what worked for you last time?
Because the lack of explanation on the business factors, we don't consider, Your Honor, our argument, World Shipping Council's argument, is that just saying that we may consider it as part of a regulatory catch-all is not sufficient under the APA to explain why the FMC is departing from past precedent. We both don't believe that we should have to wait until some future adjudication. We believe that violation under the APA exists now, and that's why we're challenging it now.
Mr. Governor, in your reply brief, you deal with the state of California case of the commission. And your response is that to the commission is that that Congress expressly removed the relevant authority in 1984, and continuing on that a removal of this authority, as well as Congress's removal of the commission's general rate-making authority, suggests that California would be decided differently under the current version of the shipping. So looking at the then prevailing and now incumbent versions, I see that when California was decided, 1944, I think, every such carrier shall establish, observe, and enforce just and reasonable regulations and practices. Whenever the board finds that such regulation or practice is unjust or unreasonable, it may determine, prescribe, and order enforced a just and reasonable regulation or practice, which in 1944 was prescribing rate change. Current version, a common carrier may not fail to establish, same as most establish, observe and enforce just and reasonable regulations and practices, etc. Commission may prescribe regulations to carry out its duties and powers. What is lacking in the current version that was present before that could explain, that could put California to one side?
So the state of California, you're right, Your Honor, a 1944 Supreme Court case cited by the commission to support its inclusion of the rate-making factor. That case was decided under the 1916 Act.
I just read the provisions from 16 and from the current.
So the provision under the 1916 Act, Your Honor, The difference is that the FMC in that case, pardon me, the rate making authority in that case,
they didn't have authority over the carrier in question, well, or the port in question, because it was a state entity. Right, so they didn't have regular, they didn't have rate making authority over that entity. I think it was the city of Oakland, but nonetheless, because there was an unjust, unreasonable practice, so found, they were able to prescribe a rate as the cure.
And Your Honor is right to determine, prescribe an order. Enforced just and reasonable practice, but they were utilizing their authority in the 1916 Act in that case, their rate-making authority that they don't have now. And that is why we believe that the removal of that authority in 1918...
They're using their rate-making authority when they didn't have rate-making jurisdiction over that entity.
Well, Your Honor, the court's reasoning in the state of California case was that the commission could require certain compensatory charges due to Congress's, and this is quoting from the case, Congress's unlimited grant of the power to stop those practices. So the practices in question in the California case related to compensatory charges, and the unlimited grant of power that the Supreme Court referred to was the authority that the commission had prior to 1984, relating to its power to regulate charges.
The withholding of rate making, this is from the case, the withholding of rate making power for services other than water carriage does not qualify the unlimited grants of the commission the power to stop effectively all unjust and unreasonable practices in regard to handling of freight. Finding a wrong which it is duty bound to remedy, the commission may, within the general framework of the act, fashion the tools for so doing. Seems to be pretty clear that they're just saying they don't have rate-making authority, they've got an unjust practice, they have to deal with it, and they can do it by prescribing a rate.
Your Honor, I would answer your question this way, which is only then the situation that we have before us is very different than the state of California case. The situation that we have before us is not just determining, prescribing, and ordering as it relates to the rate-making factor. What the FMC has done here is that we're going to consider whether or not a rate is so high above market rates to be considered unreasonable. We say there are two problems with that. One, from a statutory perspective, how does this play out? So somebody challenges an ocean carrier rate and it goes to the commission and the commission says, that's too high. It's too high above a market rate. One, we don't know what market rate they're using to compare it to, but the carrier's only then remedy on this one is to reduce its rate because the commission just told it that it was too high. And that, how does that play out? That plays out by, well, what if the shipper then continues to say, no, the carrier's rate is still too high, and goes back to the commission and says, still too high. The commission then, under this rule, can say, your charge is still unreasonable because your rate is too high. That process would go until ultimately the carrier charges something that's consistent with whatever rate the commission determines to be reasonable. If that's not rate setting, then it's hard to see what is.
Well, the way it plays out, I take that scenario, I think it's an accurate portrayal of what to expect. I'm just not sure why it's different in the end, because it is in the end prescribing the rate, right? Let's accept that it is.
And Your Honor, it is interesting that, one, the FMC has not pointed to a single statutory provision that allows for this type of rate because it can't.
Here, as you said, in California, the result was to require a compensatory charge. The problem was their charges were too low.
That's right.
The demurrage charges. So they're distorting the market for attracting traffic to Oakland. And so they said the only way to correct the preferential and unreasonable results of non-compensatory charges was to require compensatory charges, to prescribe a rate, in other words. Right?
And
you're saying, well, effectively, that's what they're doing here by indirection. And I think if you're correct, it's still within what happened there.
That's right, Your Honor. And I would say it's interesting that the only case that the FMC cites to support its rate-making factor is a 1944 case when the FMC had rate-making authority. They don't have any other cases decided. And this is rape. And what courts have held is that agencies cannot do indirectly what they're
making duty. Authority over Oakland. So that's your problem.
Can I ask a question coming at it a little differently, the same set of issues, though? The statute prohibits unreasonably refusing to deal or negotiate. So if a rate that's proposed is so stratospheric that it's indicative of a refusal to reasonably deal or negotiate, is that something that the commission can take into account?
It's your honor's question is a situation that the FMC discussed in their brief. They use the words, well, what if a rate is so absurdly high that it can't possibly be considered a refusal, an actual good faith negotiation? The answer is one, we don't know what the FMC means by absurdly high. Nobody does.
Do you disagree that there's no such thing?
But nevertheless, that's right. If Congress wanted the FMC to have the authority to regulate rates, it would have expressly given them that authority.
I'm trying to get my answer. So suppose they say $1 billion. Okay, do you think that's something that the commission just can't consider?
Not as a factor for reasonableness, Your Honor. That's right. That's a rate-making factor. And I would add, too, to that, that there's Congress has made this decision. And the reason is that's ignoring market realities to say that there's nothing that can be done.
How about this? They say, I'm not going to negotiate with you. That clearly is a violation.
It is, and that's expressed in the FMC's.
Okay, and then they say, oh, darn it, I have to negotiate. Okay, $1 billion. So your answer is?
The FMC doesn't have the authority to use rate making as a factor of reasonableness. But if the carrier offers $1 million, there's only two ways that a carrier can make that offer, either through a service contract or through a tariff. If it makes it through a service contract, the shipper is just going to turn around and go in a very competitive industry to any other carrier that's going to give them a much different rate, obviously. If that billion dollars is in the tariff, well, an ocean carrier has now just effectively turned away its entire customer base. It's precisely those market realities that cause Congress to say that the market polices itself, and there isn't a role for the FMC in this space. So, Your Honor, the answer to your question is no, that's not a factor that the commission can consider as reasonableness, even under the hypothetical that you've used.
So they consider refusal to deal in that hypothetical situation based on something other than the rate that's proposed.
That's right.
That's the way you would look at that?
Yes.
And what would they look at if the only thing that's on the table is a rate of $1 billion?
I understand your Honor's question. And I guess, first of all of this is done on a case-by-case basis, right? And the commission—
That is the case.
If that's the only case, then WSC's position is that is a rate factor that the commission simply doesn't have the authority in the Shipping Act to utilize.
That's not a refusal to deal, then?
Not under the commission's authority under the Act.
Does it have the exact same effect as an express refusal to deal?
So, in practice, I understand the question, but it comes down to whether or not the FMC has this authority to consider it as a reasonableness factor or not. It comes back to the Act itself, and if the court accepts WSC's argument that the FMC does not have the authority to consider rates as a factor in a reasonableness analysis, because Congress not only did not give them that authority in the Shipping Act, but it took that authority away, then that's not something the FMC can use as a factor under reasonableness.
Company A says, I won't deal. Company B says, I'll deal, but the cost is $1 billion. There is no practical difference in the effect of those two companies' choices, correct?
Correct. Practically, that's true. And under the market realities, you've then got companies C, D, all the way down to M, in which case there are competitive options for these shippers. And this
that
is
seems
not
like it would apply also in the situation A, where the company says, I won't deal. It seems like your answer would be, well, it's no big deal because you can just go find company C through M.
The commission's rule says that a categorical refusal to deal with no justification is considered unreasonable, not something that WSC disputes.
Just to play it out one more time, so to take Judge Walker's hypo and just keep it with Company A. The Company A refuses to appeal. You would say, okay, they can be justly held to account for refusing to deal. And then Company A says, oh, okay, I guess I can't refuse to deal, so $1 billion. And then you would say, Company A loses the first time, but wins the second time.
Your Honor, that's right. And that's the commission's point of saying, what if somebody does an absurdly market rate? And I would submit that Congress has already made that determination that in the first instance, that's something the FMC can find unreasonable under its authorities in the Act, and the second, it isn't.
I think I know your answer to the next question. I don't want to totally prolong it, but the Chief Judge's question was about $1 billion. Your answer would be the same if it was $1 trillion?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your answer would be the same if it was $1 trillion in pennies?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Summers.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Harry Summers for the Federal Maritime Commission. This is not an example of rate making. This is not a freestanding complaint to the agency saying, hey, this rate is too high. As the questions that more than one of your honors were asking show, this is in the context of an administrative adjudication about whether there was an unlawful refusal to deal. That's a retroactive determination about whether one particular fact pattern, you know, had an example of a rate that was so high it did not indicate a good faith negotiating posture in the context, and it only applies in the context before a deal has been made, because it's only—
So one question I had about that is, I thought the way the commission framed this is that a rate might be unreasonable, not that a really high rate would be indicative of an unreasonable refusal to deal, which that I can at least understand it for the reasons that were elucidated earlier. But is the commission's view that the rate actually itself can be unreasonable, or that a high rate can be indicative of an unreasonable refusal to deal?
This only arises in the context of enforcing the refusal to deal statute. Congress asked us to further define that statute. This is not a freestanding requirement about rates. This is one permissive factor that can be considered along with other factors, as has been discussed, in evaluating in an administrative adjudication resulting from a private party complaint or the Commission's Enforcement Division beginning an investigation into whether there was an unreasonable refusal to deal. One factor the agency may consider is whether the rate quoted was so high that it doesn't reflect good faith negotiation. And I think in the examples—
So the commission can't say the rate that you proposed, I have authority to determine whether you're unreasonably refusing to deal. The rate that you propose is unreasonable. That you think can't be done. It would have to be the rate you proposed, you know, potentially coupled with some other things, but let's just leave other things out. The rate that you proposed indicates an unreasonable refusal to deal.
I think that the commission is charged under the APA, as Judge Walker was saying, with a full evaluation, and consistent with Judge Ginsburg's decision in Evergreen, a full evaluation of all the factors in the statute and in its regulation implementing the statute. In this case, there are a number of factors and examples the commission should consider. Some may be more relevant in a particular case than others. So in the case where there was a rate that was widely at variance with the market, that would certainly likely be an important factor, but not necessarily the only factor. So it's unlikely the agency would say, case closed, we're not going to consider any of the relevant factors. It would consider others that were relevant, consistent with the APA. So that's, if that answers your question.
Well, the council tells us rates in this area are volatile and change from day to day, and there can be a great deal of dispersion among them. So what is the market rate?
I think the market rate would be determined much as it may be in litigation generally. The parties would no doubt argue about what the market rate for the particular routes, the shipping routes that were at issue in this retroactive determination, what was the market rate at that time? And there's a number of resources that parties can consult to determine shipping rates. There's online resources and platforms that regularly publish detailed analyses of what the market rates are for particular routes. The commission itself has experts who evaluate these rates, economists. And so I think there's a number of resources, just as in any litigation, parties
so you
could.
You can get pretty deeply into the weeds in terms of the rate examination. Is it fair to say that unreasonably refuse to deal or negotiate is essentially equivalent to a refusal to bargain?
I think that's
bargain being pretty much synonymous.
I think that's basically right, Your Honor. I think
so. There are probably thousands of cases under the Labor Act in which the Labor Board has brought an 8A5 charge or an 8B5 charge, claiming unreasonable, failure to bargain in good faith. And I haven't read them all, so I can't tell you, but I have read hundreds of them because I've taught the subject for some years and I've been on the court for 38 years. And I've never seen a bargain in good faith charge that was based on an employer offering too low a number for some benefit or wage, or the union demanding something too far, way above the market. It's always about the process, bargaining in good faith. I mean, so for instance, General Electric under Bulwerism could not say, we will make a firm, fair, final offer. Firm, fair, first and final offer. That's not bargaining, okay? Doesn't matter what the offer is. So I'm not sure why you have to get into rates at all in order to determine whether someone is reasonably refusing to negotiate or unreasonably refusing to negotiate.
Your Honor, I think it relates to the potential for that term to provide a method of circumvention of the statute. I think for the reasons that were discussed earlier, it would be very easy to effectively refuse to deal, perhaps because you felt you could make much more money doing something else. This is something we saw that Congress saw during the pandemic, where a lot of U.S. exports were left on the docks effectively because the carriers felt they could make a lot more money going back to overseas and bringing more products to the United States from elsewhere. Congress wanted the commission to try to strengthen this rule to avoid that.
Well, couldn't people negotiate in good faith and still come to the conclusion that they're not going to pick up this traffic? They've got better things to do?
It's possible, Your Honor, but it would be a very easy way to achieve the same result as simply refusing to negotiate at all if they could quote a rate that was absurdly high by any measure. So I think that's what the commission was trying to achieve. And it's important to remember that it's just one factor. So the commission can consider the other factors listed in the rule in an appropriate case. So it is a case-specific determination, not.
I think the example shows that in the labor area that it's possible to enforce good faith bargaining or not to prevent unreasonable refusals to bargain without getting into rates at all.
In this case, I think the commission, based on it,
a little bit dicey since rate making authority was removed.
I understand that concern, but I think this is really so far removed from actually setting rates. And in fact, other parts of the statute, for example, sections 41, 104A4, and A5, that Congress created do require that the commission evaluate, again, in the context of a retroactive determination about whether a practice was an unreasonably discriminatory practice or unfairly discriminatory, rates and charges are specifically provided for as something that the agency should look at. So I think that Congress has, even though, as has been said, the commission can no longer actually set rates, it can evaluate rates in the context of adjudicative determinations to enforce other parts of the act that address things like...
What's the remedy? If there's a complaint, a shipper's complaint, and the carrier is found to have engaged... failed to conduct self-reason.
Your Honor, in the context of a private party complaint, the remedy is typically reparations, which are in the nature of damages. So it's
reparations, a sum of money.
Yes, a sum of money.
And how would that money be measured if not against some hypothetical right?
I think it would depend on the facts of the case, but yes, that is a likely measure of damages. So
ultimately, you have to determine a benchmark rate from which to compensate reparations.
In the context of a particular case about past conduct, yes, I think there would have to be some measure of how the claimant was injured. And so to the extent that they could have
You have a statute that says, is that a statutory provision, remedies, reparations?
Yes.
Lost profits or whatever?
Yes.
Okay. So if that's the provision, then I don't see how you can determine that without engaging in what you're talking about, rate evaluation.
Yes, that's correct. But rate evaluation is very different from setting the rates.
Calculating damages is very close to setting a rate.
Well, it's evaluating one past rate on one particular fact scenario, not setting the rates. The market sets the rates. This is just a comparison point to be used in an administrative adjudication.
What if you have a case where there's just an outright refusal to deal? So take your archetypal violation where there's just flat refusal to deal. What would there be reparations or damages in that situation? And then the way you calculate it is what a reasonable rate would have been had there not been what everybody agrees is a violation, which is just an outright refusal to deal.
I think that could be the measure of damages. I think it would depend on the particular situation and what the claimant had to do or in order to move its products and perhaps in order to move its agricultural exports, or in the case that it could not move them, perhaps there would be damages related to being unable to move them. So, or perhaps unable to move them on time. So those damages would relate to the particular facts in the case. But yes, it could involve a determination of what was a reasonable market rate at that time. And it could be used by measuring data on some of the resources that I mentioned earlier. So that data is out there. So
the provision requiring allowing for reparations seems to me brings the case even closer into the California precedent.
Yes, I think that's probably right.
I don't see how it can be avoided. Okay, thank you.
The rule says, it talks about quoting rates that are so far above current market rates, and some of the questions we were asking your opposing counsel were fair or unfair, way above current market rates. Questions, I mean, a 1,000,000% higher than current market rates. What do you mean by so far above current market rates? What's the floor on so far above?
I don't think there is a precise definition, Your Honor. I think it would be very context dependent. Like so much that's in the statute that is phrased in terms like unreasonable, unfair, unjust. These are the kind of terms that Loper Bright mentioned that agencies may receive from Congress and are given a certain amount of discretion to define. Here, I think in a particular case, I believe the regulatory language is so far the market rates that they don't indicate a good faith negotiation or effort to negotiate and make a deal. I think if in a particular case the agency were to define that in a way that was unreasonable, inconsistent with the APA, there'd be reason to object, but I don't think it's required to define in advance exactly what that would be. Certainly, we couldn't assign a number because there's so many potential variables with different shipping routes and over time and different economic conditions.
And if you did assign a number, that would look a heck of a lot like rate setting.
It would, even though still it's only in the context of a larger evaluation of refusal to deal and one of many potential factors. But
Your approach, if I understand, is we don't want to rate set, so we're not going to set a number. Instead, we're going to leave you in the dark about what the number is.
I don't think it would be practical or perhaps even defensible to try to define a precise number because there are so many potentially relevant factors in a retroactive analysis of that type. So it would be very context dependent. And again, it's just one of many potential factors.
Is any shipper filing a complaint prevailed and gone to remedy since the amendment of the statute?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of one. I know there are some pending cases where the rule has been broadly cited, but I'm not aware that has happened.
Could be cases before amendment of the statute in which reparations were awarded?
I believe so, Your Honor. I don't have an example in front of me.
Okay.
Yes.
We'll find them.
I guess my concern is it has to be that sometimes a rate can be quoted that's above market rate. Otherwise, market rates would never increase, right?
Yes.
And so if they're allowed to quote rates above market rate, they're not allowed to quote rates that are too far above market rate. You don't tell them what too far is. Seems like quite the bind there.
Your Honor, I think the language in the regulation is very strong in the sense that it's a very strong expression that the rate is very far removed from the market rates, so far above that it does not indicate a good faith negotiation. I think that's not like a small, you know, inflation level increase. That's something more. And I think if the agency were to act unreasonably in evaluating that in a particular case, there would be certainly grounds to object and an opportunity on the part of the responding carrier to object to that. But in the abstract, and just based on the regulation by itself in the abstract, I think it's a reasonable expression of an important method to avoid circumvention of the statute.
If you prevail here, and then if at a certain point a petition is filed saying, you know, we quoted a rate and it really wasn't so far above current market rates, but, you know, it was used against us. I'm on the panel. I'm going to quote what you just said in deciding the case. I'm sure you think is fair.
Fair enough.
I suppose you could also have a concern on the commission's part that if you tried to identify some kind of parameter on what is so far above that it would pose an issue, that it could be that there's actually a good explanation for why something that's far above actually shouldn't pose an issue. And I assume the commission's open to being persuaded on that. And one reason why you might be reluctant, the commission might be reluctant to try to identify a number or a range could be that number or range could turn out actually not to be prohibitive. And in fact, it turns out that you can be within the realm of good faith negotiation and still propose something that might at first appear to be outsized because of some contextual considerations that just are unpredictable at the moment.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's right. I think in many cases, the kind of scenario you suggest would actually cause the market to change. And so such a rate that was for those reasons would also affect the rates being charged elsewhere, other carriers are quoting. But if for some reason that wasn't the case, there are the other permissive factors in the rule to be considered. And it may be that those factors would outweigh this one in the analysis. And in fact, there is the catch-all provision where the agency will consider any other relevant factors or elements that may bear on that decision. So the carrier could certainly, citing those provisions, make that argument, and the commission, I believe, would consider that carefully. So.
Can I ask you about the business decisions
regulation?
Will business decisions be a less important part of the analysis than they were before this challenge regulation was promulgated?
Your Honor, I understand the question. I don't think that the commission indicated that they would be less important. I think that it elected, after consideration starting in the NPRM and through the SNPRM and in the final rule, not to include that as an explicit factor in its new rule. There had never been a rule like this before, so it wasn't like it was changing some previous rule. It didn't include that. It did point to the the apparent potential for the factor to be given more weight than some of the commenters felt was appropriate. It elected not to specifically put it in the regulation. However, it made very, very clear in the preamble and the other rulemaking documents that that was a factor that was still potentially relevant, that the agency would consider going forward. It made mention of the past adjudications in which that had been a factor, which my friend cited in the brief. Those remain relevant. The history of this is that it was a statute that was explained in adjudications over the years, and all that material remains relevant here. The rule didn't prohibit consideration. In fact, those catch-all provisions that I just mentioned are what allows the business decisions to still be considered.
So that all sounds pretty fine. There were a couple lines in the brief, though, that seemed more aggressive. One of them is you say that the petitioners seem to be using business decisions as a kind of code for always seeking to charge the highest rate, as the commission recognizes. I understand that in terms of what the carriers give, there's going to be plenty of requirements and they're going to be expensive and that's going to cut into profit margin maybe. But in terms of what the carriers get, the money they get for carrying, I don't understand why they wouldn't always seek to charge the highest rate.
I think the import of language you're talking about isn't that they can't seek to make a profit. It's just that that's not the only consideration in making the kind of determination.
When should they not seek to charge the highest rate?
Well, I don't think they... I think if they sought $1 billion, then that would be an unlawful refusal to deal. So there are contexts where that...
Which is a scenario that you've already covered. For your other regulation. I mean, I think what your argument is in defense of that regulation is it's not really going to the rate. It's using an exorbitantly high rate as a pretext for not dealing. I would think, especially if these companies are publicly owned, it would be perhaps even illegal in terms of their duty to their shareholders to not seek to charge the highest rate.
It's really part of a larger analysis. So it's not that they can't or shouldn't seek to charge a high rate. It's that if in evaluating why they refuse to deal or why they refuse to provide cargo space, a factor is what their position, shall we say, as to these business factors or business decisions. It's not an automatic basis to evade the statute, cite that. So that's
not at all what petitioners are asking for, and that's not at all how the proposed rule would have read. The proposed rule would have just said business decisions are a factor that the commission considers.
And they are still a factor. So I feel like it's where Congress hasn't required that we state any particular factor in the rule.
You said they are still a factor. I just want to pin that down. It would not be okay for the commission to decline to consider a relevant business decision, correct?
I agree with that. A relevant business decision, yes. Yes.
Because it would be arbitrary not to.
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
If the objective is to determine whether they are negotiating in good faith, the question about the rate is, I think should be, whether that rate is indicative of a desire ever to reach agreement.
I believe that's right, Your Honor. Yes.
Or not just that rate, but any rates, counteroffers, and so on.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. McGovern, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to just address a few things that have been discussed today. First, on what I will refer to as the $1 billion hypothetical, I mentioned that there are two ways for a carrier to price their ocean transportation services. One is through a service contract, one is through a public tariff. In the billion-dollar hypothetical we're talking about, ocean carrier A goes to a customer, a potential customer, and says, sure, I'll move your cargo, but only for $1 billion. We have to keep in mind, too, that that customer, not just the competitive options that I've mentioned earlier today, but that customer also has the ability to move cargo under the ocean carrier's tariff. And the tariff will not say $1 billion. And the reason a tariff will not say $1 billion is because if it does, it's effectively turned off its entire customer base. So there are options here. And, you know, the reality is understanding the court's practical questions about it. But there is a way for the way that the market works for a shipper to get the service it's asking.
Well, you're saying that no one ever pays more than the tariff?
Usually the tariff is on the higher side, and usually through an individually negotiated confidential service contract, you come to a lower rate. That's usually the case.
You referred to the instability of the rates and market rates being all over the place. Well, now you're telling us up below whatever the tariff rate happens to be. Is there a public source of information on that?
Tariffs are publicly filed.
No. Of the fluctuation in rates. You said there was, I think you indicated there's a commercial service or something that publishes.
The commission mentioned that there are a number of public services that are available. Things like companies like Alpha Liner and Piers and Drury. There are people who do monitor the rates.
And are those all behind a paywall?
Many are behind a paywall.
Is there one that's not?
Among the ones that I've just mentioned, Your Honor, they're all behind a paywall. Okay. And on that point, on the market rates, you know, the rule, despite what we heard from my colleague today, the rule doesn't say anything about what a market rate would be or where it would be developed. It doesn't say anything about any of these public services or how the FMC would determine what would be too high. And it doesn't say anything about what deviation between an actual rate and a market rate would be. We just don't know. And at that point, that gives carriers have no ability then to run their businesses, and the FMC has a discretion to just decide for itself without any clarity in the rule. The FMC, in its brief and here today, also
on the business decisions regulation, you heard the government just say that the commission must consider relevant business decisions. If that's how we read the regulation, do you have standing?
We still do have associational standing, Your Honor, to challenge all three of these, but that's not what the regulation says.
But how are you injured by a regulation that is read to require the commission to consider relevant business decisions?
If the regulation were to be read that they must consider business decisions,
relevant business,
that's in line with its past precedent, and therefore there's not an APA violation. The APA violation here is
you wouldn't be injured.
Not if that's how you read the regulation. That is not, Your Honor, how we read the regulation, and I'm not sure how the FMC reads it that way either.
If we read it the same way the FMC reads it and holds in a published opinion, you don't have standing. It seems like you've basically gotten what you wanted.
On the business factors, Your Honor, you're right about that. On rate making, if I can go back, the commission in its brief and here today said, look, this is just one permissive factor we may or may not consider. That's really just downplaying its statutory overreach here. And the FMC has made clear that these rate factors are, in their words, critical and significant. So the inverse is also true. Under the way that the FMC has structured the rule, our reading of the rule, rates could be the only factor that the commission considers to find unreasonable, and we would be, and carriers would be left without any recourse there. And lastly, Your Honors, there's a theme throughout the FMC's brief and also, you know, mentioned here today, which is, you know, Congress gave the FMC broad authority because to adopt a rule to address serious supply chain concerns. But Congress's direction in this rule was clear, it was narrow, and it was simple. Define the term unreasonable. Here's what Congress didn't do. It did not reinsert the authority for the FMC to regulate ocean carrier prices. It did not remove the core purposes of the Shipping Act that the FMC regulate with minimal government intervention. And it did not give the FMC the ability to depart from past precedent without reasoned explanation. So we ask that the court vacate the rules rate-making export policy provisions that exceed the authority in the Act, and at a minimum ask that the court remand the case back to the FMC to explain how each of these disputed factors are relevant to and would be used in any reasonable analysis.
Mr. McGovern, before you leave, is there any commission supervision of the tariff rates?
Tariff rates are publicly filed, and so that
in any way constrained.
So that other than the requirement in the Shipping Act that they be publicly filed, they don't have any authority to determine a tariff rate up or down.
And tariff rates, would you say, still commonly the ones charged, or is most everything under service contracts now?
Your Honor, roughly speaking, it's about, my understanding is it's about 75% service contract, 25% tariff. But actually, this gets to, Your Honor, this gets to the point that the commission has made. There are other comparable provisions in the statute. They're not comparable provisions. Actually, you know, they're very different. And the ones that, you know, the FMC has talked about, 4502, 41104, those are all just requirements to file a service contract, requirements that carriers adhere to their tariff. Those are general monitoring requirements, but the FMC doesn't have any authority to tell a carrier what it can and should charge in a service contract or a tariff, because Congress never gave them that authority.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. Take this case under submission.